is going to be on the relationship between Pshat and Drash. The makoros for that begin on page 9. Last week we discussed the importance of studying Machshava, and one of the things that we noted is that Machshava means many different things for many different people, and each or the differing aspects of Machshava do emphasize different things. There's obviously a difference between Kabbalah and Agadah and philosophy and the like. And over the course of the year, Be'ezus Hashem, we're going to consider these different aspects. But as the sources in Chazal that we saw last time emphasize, a large part of Machshava is Agadah. And what I wanted to talk to you about today is the study of Medrash and Chazal and the like. In a sense, this could be a Parshanut question. How do we relate Pshat to Drash? And I think it's something that we've all thought about. But I'd like to address a particular question, and I hope that through addressing this question, we will gain a more general understanding of the goal of Medrash and the goal of Agadah. I also forgot to bring this the roster for you to sign in, so next week, Be'ezus Hashem, you'll sign in retroactively for 2 weeks. But I'm sure you'll remember if you were here or not. It's very memorable. Okay. So take a look at, again, page 9 in your source books. Chazal frequently express the notion that Torah can be understood on many levels. Shivim panim la Torah, there are 70 faces to Torah. Kipatish yifotzeit sela, ma patish zemes chalek, lakama nitzotos af, mikra achod yotze, lakama ta'amim. So just like if a hammer smashes a stone, it breaks up into many different pieces, so too, when we study a pasuk, we could interpret the pasuk in many ways. And generally speaking, we assume that the multiple interpretations of the Torah are correct. And that, page 9, and are correct simultaneously. In other words, you could interpret a single pasuk on many different levels. In fact, the Radvaz writes, that is the reason why there are no nekudos in a chumash, in an actual Torah scroll. Why? Because by leaving out nekudos and leaving out punctuation, so we could read a pasuk in many ways. You'll see, for example, sometimes the mefarshim will translate a pasuk differently than the trup. So by leaving out punctuation, even nekudos, so we could pronounce a word in multiple ways, that allows for multiple interpretations. On a deeper level, the Ramban famously explains that the entire Torah is Shemos of Hashem in his Hakdamat Chumash, and that by combining the Shemos in different ways, it allows to convey lots of information at the same time, lots of interpretations. So all that is very simple, except that the question is, what happens when they contradict each other? In other words, the interpretation of a pasuk al pi pshat is different, and not only different, but contradicts the interpretation al pi pshat. Now, this could be a philosophical contradiction, it could be a contradiction in tone or message, and sometimes, and that's actually what I'd like to consider with you today, it's a contradiction in metzius, meaning to say, there's a stira. What actually happened? If you read the pasuk al pi pshat, you would get the impression that X happened, and when you look at the midrashim, you get the impression that Y happened. And here, it's hard to simply say, at least it would seem, well, they both happened because they contradict each other. They both can't happen. One happened or the other happened. And that being the case, we could wonder, well, which one actually did happen? Did the events transpire as depicted by the Chazal, by the Medrash, or did the events transpire as depicted by the Psukim? And while perhaps one could try to argue that they're both true, this relates to a topic I'd like to consider with you another time, the nature of Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim. The Maral, for example, in his Hakdamah to Gevurah Hashem, argues for such a possibility that the sun, in the story of Shemesh B'Givon Dome, it both stopped and didn't stop. From the perspective of Klal Yisrael, that are Lamala Menatav, it stopped, and for the perspective of the rest of the world, it didn't stop. So maybe you could imagine such a possibility of both contradictory descriptions having happened, but the Pashut understanding is that that's not the case. We'll see examples in a moment, but either it was X or Y, it couldn't be both. So here it's much more complicated. When it's just two different ways to read the Pasuk, two different ways to darshan the Pasuk, we'll say they're both true. One is true on a level of Pshat, one is true on a level of Drash. When you're talking about events that took place, so one wonders, well, which one actually happened? And again, this is an interesting question. I think a lot of people wonder about it, but I think addressing this question will also help us understand the goal in a broader sense of Medrash. So let's consider a couple of examples where it seems to me that at least some of the Rishonim seem to assume that the actual physical reality corresponded to the description in Pshat as opposed to Drash. So here's one example, which is on the top of page 9. Top page 10. When was Yocheved, or where was Yocheved born? So, as you all know, Chazal note that there's a problem. It says 70 Jews went down with Yaakov Avinu to Mitzrayim. When you count them, that there are only 69 in among the family of Leah. When you count them, there's 32, though it says there's 33. So how do we account for that? So Chazal, Rashi cites it, says Yocheved was born Ben HaChomos, meaning, say, on her way down to Yerushalayim, on the way down to Mitzrayim. That's why she's not included in the list of names, because she wasn't someone that, as it were, left Canaan, but she is someone that entered Mitzrayim, and therefore there are actually 70. And there are a number of other answers. The Rush, for example, says the Torah rounds up when it deals with it's a 9 in the ones place, like Makos 39 to 40, Sfirsa Omer, right? It says Tisperu Chamishim Yom, we only count 49. So there are different answers, but that's what Chazal say, Nolda Ben HaChomos. So the Ibn Ezra objects. You have that over here. And Ibn Ezra says, among other things, that would mean that Yocheved gave birth to Moshe when she was 130. Why? Well, if she was, the Jewish people were in Egypt for 210 years, and Moshe was born 80 years before they departed, so that means he was born when his mother was 130, assuming she was born on the way down to Egypt. Now, if that happened, Ibn Ezra doesn't deny the possibility of miracles, but he assumes that such an incredible miracle would be mentioned in the Torah. After all, look how big of a deal the Torah makes about Sarah's giving birth at the age of 90. And here this was 40 years afterwards. No mention is given. So he doesn't think that's correct. He gives a different interpretation to the Pasuk, to answering the question of the inconsistency in terms of numbers. Ramban, as we'll see a little later, disagrees with Ibn Ezra. But first, let's consider some other examples. But the point that I wanted to stress is that Ibn Ezra is saying that the events depicted in the Medrash did not actually happen. He proves it on textual grounds, meaning to say it's inconsistent with the simple reading of the Pasuk. Now, the truth is, you might be able to read Ibn Ezra two ways. You could say that, well, he's saying the Medrash is simply wrong, or he's saying, I'm not going to say whether the Medrash is right or wrong, but it doesn't correspond with Pshat, but it's pretty clear, and I don't really think that works for this Medrash, he's pretty clear he's saying that the events that occurred, in other words, when was Yocheved actually born? She was not born Ben HaChomos, right? We have Pshat, we have Drash. What actually happened is the Pshat. And on a level of Pshat, it It's inconceivable she was born Bein HaChomos. This is a fascinating... Yes?
Meaning, it's one thing for the Torah. The Torah isn't limited to assume that the pasuk means X or Y, but the Medrash doesn't have Pshat and Drash. So, meaning, how are you supposed to understand the Medrash, which seems to be saying this
okay,
was
good.
Messiah?
So, one question we're going to discuss, which we're going to get to later, if not this week, then next week, Be'ezras Hashem, is going to be the extent to which we, or a Rishon, could argue with Chazal, and is there a difference between arguing about halachic matters versus non-halachic matters, midrashic, interpretation, and the like. You see this in Ramban, for example, when he says about a medrash, it's eno nachon. Does he just mean it's not right al pi pshat, or is he saying it's not right? So we're going to get back to that, and what might be the correct interpretation of Ramban might be different for Ibn Ezra and the like. So we're going to return to exactly how to deal with that. But for now, suffice it to say that in terms of what actually happened, if you asked Ibn Ezra, he would say, we don't know exactly when Yocheved was born, but it was not Bein HaChomos. Okay. This is a fascinating interpretation of the Ran. I just think it's a... It's in its own right, it's really fascinating, but also relates to this point. The Ran here is bothered by a obvious question. The context I'll mention to you first is actually dealing with the problem of evil, and he notes that God doesn't intervene, generally speaking, supernaturally to affect individuals. Someone who sins isn't struck by lightning. And he uses this principle to explain why the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer, and how do we deal with the problem of evil? And his answer relates to the nature of hashgacha. Hopefully, again, later in the year, we'll have a chance to study the sugya of hashgacha pratis and what that means. But he gives the following suggestion based off of this idea that Hashem doesn't, generally speaking, step in to alter Teva to explain a fascinating question. The question is, why is it that the Torah makes such a big deal of Makas Bechoros, and we offer so much gratitude for being spared during Makas Bechoros? In fact, there are many mitzvos that are based off of this. You should have been killed during the 10th plague, you meaning the Jewish firstborn children, and they weren't, and therefore they have to offer gratitude and the like. So the question is, of course, why would you expect them to have been killed? They didn't deserve to be killed, right? If somebody... I go ahead, I turn on the radio, I hear that a murderer was executed. So I don't say, Baruch Hashem, I wasn't executed. Why? Because there's no reason why I should be executed, as far as I know. Never murdered anybody. So I'm not going to be so grateful. Why do we make such a big deal? Every Jewish person has to offer gratitude that they weren't killed during Makas Bechoros. Why should they have been killed? So he suggests the following. He suggests that the truth of the matter is, right, just for example, take a look at the pasuk that you have over here, again, page 10, the second source, Ki nusunim nusunim hemali, mitoch b'nei Yisrael, tachas pitras kol rechem b'chor kol, mikol Yisrael, lakachti yosam li, ki li kol b'chor b'vnei Yisrael, ba'adam uva behema. B'yom ha'kosi chol b'chor b'eretz Mitzrayim hikdashti osam li. Again, why? Why so much gratitude? Why is that so significant? So he says the following fascinating idea. When Hashem brings punishment on a group of people, he does so in a more naturalistic way. So if Hashem wanted the firstborns of the Egyptians to be killed, so he didn't just zap each firstborn Egyptian, but he presumably created some type of disease, some type of condition that would have affected the firstborn Egyptians. Now, if that's true, so then the Jewish people should have also been affected. Apparently, he assumes that there's some type of a biological condition that relates to firstborn children, and that is what was affected in Makas Bechoros, that every Peter Rechem was killed. The Jewish people were saved, and therefore, since the Jewish people were miraculously saved from a perspective of Teva, they should have been killed, because there was a disease that affected every firstborn child. They should have been killed. They were saved. For this, they offer gratitude. For this, they were sanctified, and so on and so forth. Okay, fascinating. And then he says, well, one second. If that's true, so that would only affect the Peter Rechem, firstborn on a mother's side. Firstborn on a father's side isn't biologically distinct. There's nothing different about them. There's no such thing as a disease that would affect all firstborns, only Peter Rechem's, only firstborn for the mother. So he says, yeah, in Achanami, which would also explain why the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen, for example, is only for Peter Rechem. But he says, one second, don't Chazal say that, Rashi quotes it on the Pasuk, that every firstborn died, both firstborns of the father and firstborns of the mother. So look at how he answers the question. Af al pi, she'amru b'medrash, ein bayis asher ein sham meis, ein sham b'chor gadol abayis karui b'chor. The Medrash, Rashi quotes, states that every bias had a mace. Well, one second, what if there wasn't a b'chor in the house? No. Gadol Shabayas was considered the b'chor for these purposes. Now, that obviously contradicts his pshat, because his pshat was that there was this biological disease affecting the Peter Rechems, not just the oldest in the house. So he says, Zel tzad hadrash, aval kafi pshuto shel davar. So it's only a b'chor shahayu nitlam b'pitrei harachamim heim shalaku. Good. So what is he saying? Again, he seems to be saying that what really happened was only Peter Rechem's, firstborn from the mother, were killed. What about the Medrash? Zehu al dera al tzad hadrash. But it's not what actually happened. It's not what literally happened. The Medrash doesn't correspond to the physical reality. The Pshat corresponds to the physical reality. Another example. This we'll do a little more quickly because I want to get to the answer. But there are really many examples. The Abarbanel says that among the Bnei Yaakov, only Yosef was buried in Eretz Yisrael. All the other sons were buried in Egypt. He says, what about the Medrash that says all 12 sons were buried in Israel? He says that's not what actually happened, because if that were the case, the Pasuk should have mentioned it. It only mentions that Yosef was buried, so therefore it was only Yosef. Again, assuming, you know, methodologically, Abarbanel's point is very similar to the Ibn Ezra that we saw first. The assumption that if an important event actually happened, as depicted by the Medrash, it would have been included in the actual Pasuk. It would have been said explicitly. The fact that it wasn't stated explicitly implied that it doesn't happen. It's sort of interesting because when you look at some of the Mefarshim and their decision not to read Midrashim literally, they're bothered by scientific plausibility or philosophical plausibility. You sometimes see that in the Rambam, for example. Here, in these examples, they're actually bothered by textual issues. But one way or the other, based off of these textual issues, again, here we've seen three thinkers, Ibn Ezra, Ran, and Abarbanel. There are others who say that what actually literally physically happened corresponds to what we understand in Pshat, not necessarily Drash. Yeah.
What do we do with
the
actual reality? Do we dismiss?
That's what we're trying to figure out. Good. So if that's the case, yes.
So when you say usually if you have a different type of understanding of halacha by different rab, but
that's the question. What we're assuming now, and this might not be so simple, is that elu v'elu might be true in many senses, but it doesn't make sense with respect to what literally, physically happened. In other words, one thing, either they were buried in Israel or they were buried in Egypt. They weren't buried in both places, right? Either the Peter Rechems died or the Gadol Shebebayis died, but not both. Either Yocheved was born 130 years, or Moshe was born when Yocheved was 130 years old, or he wasn't. Both can't be true. Now, I mentioned before, perhaps certain models of Elu Ve'elu would allow for the possibility of both being true. That's very, very hard to understand. So I'm assuming that while we'll say Elu Ve'elu with respect to the machlokas between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel and Halacha, and certainly most machlokos in Agada, it's very easy to understand how you could say Elu Ve'elu. But here, we might say Elu Ve'elu, but one thing actually physically happened. And what is it? What happened? So what these Mefarshim are assuming is what happened is what's depicted in the Pshat, not the Drash. Now, so what's the Drash doing? If what actually happened is not what it says in the Medrash, so what is the goal of the Medrash? So that's what we're going to discuss. And hopefully, let's see if we answer your question. If not, ask it again. So let's talk about a very basic question, which is, what is the purpose of Medrash? So we saw last week a number of sources that tells us that Medrash is about teaching Yerushalayim, teaching Torah values, conveying Torah values. And there are some thinkers who write that sometimes Midrashim will resort to exaggerations in order to do so, meaning to, in order to promote those values, in order to teach Yerushalayim. One example of such a thinker is the Maariv Chiyus, which you have over here at the bottom of page 10. I just gave it to you in English. This is from his Mevola Talmud. Those of you who took Rabbi Karmi will have read this, so it'll be familiar. And he writes the following. He's talking about the Medrash that says that, it's a Gemara, that says that Esav violated five Averos on the day that he sold the birthright to Yaakov. It's Gemara Bava Basra, Tezayim Beis. The Gemara says, Chamish Averos Aver Osa Rasha B'yom Hahu, Ba'al Naira Murasa, V'harag Es HaNefesh, V'kafer B'tchias HaMesim, V'kafer B'ikar V'shatas HaBechora. Okay, and then it shows each one from Sukkim. So what does he say? The rabbis, as far as possible, praise the conduct of godly men to endeavor in every possible way to justify the doings of the good. In other words, you look at Chazal, and the Psukim describe a lot of good things that the Tzaddikim and the Chumash do, and then you look at Chazal, and it describes many, many, many more things. And the reverse, when it comes to Rishayim, you know, when you read the Psukim, Esav was not such a great guy, though you read the Pshat, and it's a bit ambiguous. And then you read Chazal, and Esav was the worst of the worst of the worst. Like the Gemara in Bava Basra says, he murdered people, he was Baal Naira Murasa, he was Kofir Be'ikr, v'chulei v'chulei. It goes without saying that they used exaggeration in the praise of the good deeds of the righteous that are expressly recorded and employed exegetical methods to show that such persons observed the laws of righteousness to a higher degree than is required, and so endeavored to reveal by exegetical interpretation what the text left unrecorded. They followed a similar important principle when referring to the evil doings of the wicked. They charged them with all other possible abominable deeds, like we just saw in the Gemara in Bava Basra. Now, let's say that that means that it doesn't literally, when the Medrash says that Esav was Baal Naira Murasa on the day he sold the Bechorah to Yaakov, that's not meant literally. After all, actually, there was no such thing as Erison. The Rambam writes, Erison was invented with Matan Torah, so how could he have been Baal Naira Murasa? So doesn't necessarily, the Matzchiah seems to be saying, you know, it's not literally that he did these five averos on that very day, but Chazal said he did all these bad things to highlight, to emphasize how big of a Rasha Esav was. Fine. So, a very important clarification is in order if we accept that, which is that it's very meduyuk. It might be the case that Chazal exaggerate and the things depicted didn't literally happen. But they're not random. They're not haphazard. They're meduyuk. And they're not just meduyuk, but they get to the heart of the matter. Or to put it differently, they give us a much truer understanding of what really happened, even if it doesn't correspond to what literally happened. Let's give an example. We'll take that example. So, one of the five averos that Esav did that day was Bal Nairan Lurasa. So we asked, what do you mean? There was no such thing as Erisin. So I once heard the following beer from my Rebbe, Rav Aaron Lapiansky, pointed out that Erisin reflects a forward-looking notion. The idea that a woman is an Ashes Ish because of an event that's going to take place in the future. Right now, she is a Naira Bevesa Viha, right? She still lives at home. She's going to get married in a year from now, and that already gives her a status of an Ashes Ish. Now, what was the Nakuda that Yaakov and Esav really disagreed about? What were they fighting about? So, if you read the Psukim carefully, Ramban points out, the attitude of Yaakov was one of future orientation. The attitude of Esav was all about the here and now. Hine anochi holech lamos, lama zeli b'chora. I'm going to die. Ramban explains, Esav's attitude was, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we shall die. All that matters is now, from his perspective, selling the Bechora for a good meal was a good deal. In fact, if you look at Chazal, they amplify this point there. Yaakov and Esav were fighting over two worlds. Yaakov was Olam Haba focused, Esav was Olam Hazeh focused. And this is certainly an idea that you see all over in Chazal, and it's an idea that you also see in Pshat if you read it carefully. As the Ramban points out, Hine anochi holech lamos. So their attitude was, Esav reflected valuing only the here and now, a rejection of the notion of thinking big picture. Yaakov reflected the idea of considering the future orientation, not just now. So if that's true, that's the pshat. When Chazal said Esav was Bal Naira Murasa, it means he rejected the idea, the concept, the notion of Erisin, the notion that your future, a future event determines your current status. And that was precisely the Nekuda that he and Yaakov debated. Yaakov disagreed. That's why the Torah has the concept of Erisin. Meaning to say that Chazal over here, it's not just exaggeration for no purpose. It's exaggeration, A, because to properly understand the psukim, one must appreciate that Yaakov and Esav were worlds apart, and the superficial reading of the psukim in which Esav is this innocent person who's duped by his conniving younger brother is wrong, but it's much deeper. Every detail of Chazal, and this is especially true if we're going to assume it's not literally true, is there to convey a very important message. And without Chazal, it's easy to totally misunderstand the message of the Torah al-Pi Pshat. Now, we're not saying that you shouldn't learn al-Pi Pshat. Adirab, it's very important to understand Pshat, and to understand Pshat on its own terms, meaning to say, not to try to shtup drash into pshat. The Gra and the Rishonim all emphasize this point. The Gra writes that many people, many of the commentaries, make lots of mistakes when they try to shtup the drash into the pshat, or show how the drash is really the pshat. No, the drash is the drash, and the pshat is the pshat. But what is the drash trying to do? And especially if we're going to say that the physical reality doesn't correspond to the drash, but rather the pshat. So what the drash is trying to do is get to the heart of the matter. In a certain sense, the pshat is the more superficial understanding. It reflects the outward appearances. The Zohar compares pshat to the clothing of a person, what you see first, whereas the drash understands represents the body of the person, the sod represents the soul of the person, each one going a little deeper, relating to the person's essence a little more. So drash is very important, and that's true regardless of whether the literal events that took place correspond to the pshat, to the drash. And you see this in a number of ways. One place I think that you see this is the famous programmatic statement of Rashbam. You have it on page 11. Many of the Pashtanim, among them Rashbam, point out that the Iker interpretation of Torah is al pi drash. They just think that there's a value, and there is a value, of studying Pshat as well. So here the Rashbam famously mentions his belief in Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto. He talks about how he discussed this with his grandfather Rashi, and Rashi conceded to his point that a lot of the things that are presented as Pshat are really Drash. Rashbam is his understanding of Pshat is much more textual or straightforward than Rashi's understanding of Pshat. And he says that Rashi agrees to him. And then he wonders, you know, why is it that before me, the Mefarshim weren't so Pshat-focused? Even Rashi, which was a Pshat-focused, nominally a Pshat-focused interpretation, is very Midrashic. So why is it? And he writes, Varishonim, you see where it's just right where the second end of the second line, Varishonim, Mitochas Hidusan, Nisasku Lintos Acharei Adrasho Shehein Iker. The Rishonim, the earlier commentaries, due to their chasidus, focused on drashos, Shehein Iker, because they're the Iker. And the Rashbam, though he is a Pashtun, fully accepts that the drash, he says, is the Iker. There's value to pshat, which is why he does it. But what's the Iker? The Iker is the drash. Umitoch kach, lo hurgalu, be'omek pshuto shel mikra. That's why, you see, they didn't appreciate the omek of pshat. It's another important thing to talk about, which is pshat isn't just simple, superficial, and the like. There's omek of pshat as well. Ulefi she'amru chachamim al tarbu b'nechem b'higayon. The Gemara says you shouldn't teach your children higayon, which Rashbam understands is a reference to pshuto shel mikra. It's not referring to logic. Some understand it's logic, but he understands. Most Rishonim understand it means pshat. Chazal said, don't spend too much time on pshat. V'gam omru hosik b'mikra amida v'en amida hosik b'talmud ein lach amida gdola mizu. And now it's important to remember this is certainly easy to understand with respect to the halachic aspects, right? We know halach l'maisa, we interpret psukim al pi drash and not pshat. If a pasuk means x al pi pshat and y al pi drash, halach l'maisa, we follow the drash. But the Rashbam is saying this is also true in the narrative sense. And the converse is also true. There's a value to studying pshat in halachic parshus as well, even when it doesn't accord with the pshat. A little later on, we'll see how Rashbam, certainly Ramban, other Mefarshim, go ahead. Rambam interpret psukim, halachic psukim, al pi pshat, and say, of course, that's not the halacha. The halacha follows X, but you still should understand even halachic psukim, al pi pshat. And moreover, we'll discuss why that's important. If, after all, you know, that's not the halacha, so why is it important to understand what the psukim are saying al pi pshat? We'll see that it's very important. Mitoch kach lo hurgalu b'pshutan shel mikraos. So the Rashbam is saying that pshat is very important, but still the drash is the ikar. And the reason for that, I believe, is as we're saying, which is that the one of the goals of Chazal, of the Midrashim, is to convey the deeper message, the truer message, in a certain sense, of the Torah. And that's why it's so important. And that's true regardless if it corresponds to the physical reality. And again, this is an idea that many of the Mefarshim say. The Rambam, for example, in his Hakdama to Mor Nevuchim, writes that a lot of the misunderstandings that people have emerge from people not understanding the prophetic texts, their inability to recognize that there are multiple layers of meaning, especially to the parables in the Torah. He talks frequently of the vulgar interpretation of a particular text, meaning to say the superficial, the simple, sometimes, though not necessarily the pshat, but that's not really what's going on. And this is, of course, important in all types of aspects, all types of parshios. The Rambam in that context specifically refers to the parshios in the early Prakim, especially of Sefer Bereishis, and understanding what their deeper meaning is and how a superficial meaning is highly misleading. Yeah, somebody had a question. Yeah.
How do we know that
Well, the Pasuk is talking about a Midrash Agada, no? It's an Eila Todos Yaakov. And if you, he's the context here is a narrative context.
I mean, like, he's talking about, like,
that too. But I think the context here is a narrative portion of the Torah. And anyway, his statement is true regardless on narrative portions as well. He's talking about Rashi on par Sefer Bereishis, right? Saying Rashi and Sefer Bereishis, Toch Hasiduso, was too midrashically focused. That's not talking about halacha. Okay. So, with this, so what have we said so far? And then really I want to get to what Iker I wanted to talk about today, which is the Mahalach of the Ramban. But so far what have we seen? That drash is meant to convey the truth of Torah on a different level than the pshat. Pshat and drash, I would argue, are both on their own incomplete. Taken together, we have a much more correct, comprehensive understanding of what the Torah's message is. We'll be better able to understand what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants of us. And that, in addition, in terms of the questions of what physically happened, so at least some of the Mefarshim assume that, generally speaking, the physical reality corresponds to the pshat. What you would have seen, as it were, if you were there, is the events as depicted by pshat. That's one of the reasons why you could wonder why some of these books that sort of... Oh, say it a little differently. That it's important that when studying Chumash to remember what the psukim actually say. It's an interesting educational question. I'm not sure I'm right, but I'm always, you know, I'm frustrated sometimes when my kids come home, little kids, and it's time to describe what happened in the parsha, and you know, the stories that their depiction of the events are oftentimes, you know, they're based off of Midrashim. This is more of an educational question. So I don't want to do that now. But it's an important educational question to think about. You know, when my 4-year-old daughter comes home and she's describing the story of Rivka. And so she mentioned that her teacher goes ahead and fills up like a big bucket of water and asks them to pick it up. And of course, no one in the class could pick it up because it weighs 40 pounds and they weigh 35 pounds. And so then the teacher tells them all about how you know, Rivka was 3 years old and she carried 10 of these buckets and watered all of the sheep of Eliezer and the like. And that's almost like the thing that they take home from that story is how this 3-year-old was able to carry hundreds of pounds of water, hundreds of gallons of water to water 10 camels. She tells them exactly how much a camel drinks. I guess she looked that up also. So it's an interesting question. Is that you know, it is based off of Chazal. Do Chazal there mean it literally? And if so, is this the message? Is this the version of the story that we're supposed to have? So it's something that's important to think about, though not for now. So yes, I'd like to turn to the Ramban. I think we're going to see that the Ramban almost has the opposite approach. But the first point I want to see in the Ramban is a very fascinating idea, which is from the Ramban's perspective, it seems to me that what actually happened is not at all important. It's very important, and he does this all over the place, to explain the Psukim al-Pi Pshat, to explain the Psukim al-Pi Drash. But there's never an attempt to discuss, to figure out what actually happened. And the impression you get, at least that I get from the Ramban, is that it's not particularly important. So we go back, for example, to the first story, what we mentioned from Yocheved. So the Ramban over there disagrees with Ibn Ezra. He maintains that the fact that the Medrash, the fact that the Psukim don't mention that Yocheved was 130 years old, doesn't indicate that it doesn't happen, because the Torah leaves out many details from many of the stories, right? Most of the stories, life of Yaakov, the life of Yitzchak, we know of a handful of events that happened in their lives. Certainly Yocheved's life, we know very little. Levi's life, we know very little. The Torah does not give us all the details. It tells us certain stories that are important for us to know, and many of the details are filled out by the Medrash. And especially, the Ramban says the Torah tends to leave out Nisim Nistarim, and Ramban argues that this is a Nes Nistar. Now, that's not at all obvious why that would be. If you would have asked me, a woman giving birth at 130 years old is a Nes Nigla. To understand why the Ramban thinks that this was a Nes Nistar demands of us something that I hope we'll do later on. A better understanding of the Ramban's perspective on Hashkacha and what Nisim are and the like. There are also technical points. He thinks that Yocheved, having given birth earlier, wasn't as incredible as Sarah, who had never given birth. Sarah's case was different. It was predicted by a prophet. There are other differences. But one way or the other, he says that the fact that the Torah left out these details doesn't mean that they didn't happen. You shouldn't assume that just because the Torah doesn't mention it doesn't mean it didn't happen, which is sort of the approach that we saw the Abarbanel, the Ibn Ezra taking. Fine. But that's a smaller point. So here Ramban is basically saying that the Medrash saying that Yocheved gave birth at 130 doesn't contradict the Pshat. So there's no reason to assume it's not literally true. But the question is, what would Ramban say about cases where Pshat and Drash do seem to conflict? So let's consider some examples. So the Ramban, we're going to consider some examples that are about fundamental questions. Like, the first one we'll consider is, when were the mitzvos given, right? When were the mitzvos given? That seems like a very fundamental question. And the Ramban basically answers that it depends if you approach the issue from a perspective of pshat or drash. Ramban writes that according to drash, all the mitzvos and their details were given at Sinai. However, he writes that according to pshat, many of the mitzvos were given at Ohel Moed, in a Mishkan, short time later. And he shows, and that's why he keeps on coming back to this point in many places in his Perashah L'Chumash, this question of when were the mitzvahs given affects the meaning of many psukim, right? For example, the opening pasuk in Sefer Vayikra implies that the mitzvos described in the book of Vayikra were given at Ol Moed, meaning to say after Moshe had descended from Har Sinai. According to Chazal, however, this was a repetition. The mitzvos, including those in Vayikra, were given at Sinai, them and their details, and they were repeated at Ol Moed. Another pasuk that this would relate to is on page 11. Zos ha-Torah lola la mincha v'lachatas l'Hashem l'amulim v'lazev ha-chashlamim asher tiva Hashem es Moshe behar Sinai biyom tzavo so es b'nei Yisrael l'akrivis karbonayim l'Hashem b'midbar Sinai. So here we have Har Sinai and Midbar Sinai. So Ramban begins by noting that according to the Drash, all mitzvos were given at Sinai, but the simple understanding of this pasuk indicates that some mitzvos were given at Har Sinai and some mitzvos were given at Midbar Sinai, meaning Ol Moed. And Ramban again refers to this discrepancy in a number of places, and he never bothers telling us what actually happened. In other words, if you ask Ramban when were mitzvos given, he would say, Al Pi Pshat, they were given some at Har Sinai, some later. Al Pi Drash, they were all given at Har Sinai. And there's no attempt to resolve the question. He just says, both are true, and the like. I'll give you another example. Was Avram thrown into a fiery furnace? We all know that the Torah doesn't really give us too much of an introduction about Avram Avinu's early history. Ramban actually discusses why that would be, though that's not our concern at present. And the Ramban says that there's a famous medrash, we all know, or Kazdim, that Avram Avinu preached monotheism, and he was, for that reason, thrown into a furnace by Nimrod, and he was miraculously saved. Then the Ramban notes that a similar event is recorded in a non-Jewish source known as the Nabataean Agriculture. It's a book that the Rambam frequently uses in Mor Nevuchim. He understood it was an ancient Sabian text. And let's look at what the Ramban says. So this is the top of page 12 now. Va'inyan shekiblu rabosenu b'zehu emes. V'ani mevayer oso. So this Kabbalah that Chazal have about Avram and the furnace is true, and I'm going to explain it to you. Avram Avinu lo nolad be'eretz ha-kazdim. There's a whole debate between Rashi and Ramban where exactly Avram was born. Need not concern us at present. Fa'inyan ha-mekubal hazeh nimtza gam kein b'sefer kadmonei ha-goyim kemo she'kasav ha-rav ha-mor nevuchim. This event is also described in this non-Jewish source. Ki yizkiru b'sefer avodas ha-acharim ha-mitzrim ki Avram asher nolad b'kuta Chalak al-das ha-hamon. So this work describes how Avram, who was born in Kuta, disagreed with the predominant view, she'ovdim ha-shemesh, who worshipped the sun. V'nasan ha-melech oso bebeis ha-sawar. The king put him in jail. V'hayimayim b'tochachos, yamim rabim, sham he would debate them for many days. Achar kach pachad ha-melech she'yashchis alav arzo, v'yasir b'nei adam me'emunasam. The king was then concerned that he would cause people to stray. Avram was a threat because he was undermining the idolatrous system that was in place. V'garish oso, and therefore he expelled Avram Avinu al k'tzei ha'aretz kenan achar shalakach kol honos. So there's a difference, right? Similar story, but a lot of details differ. Instead of the king throwing Avram into a furnace and Avram's being miraculously saved, we have the king expelling him from the country for preaching and practicing monotheism. So there are similarities, right? Avram gets in trouble with the law for practicing monotheism, but there are differences. Like, was it a expulsion or was it a fiery furnace? Vihine, after presenting the non-Jewish version of this story, he writes, Vihine al kol panim b'makom ahu b'eretz kasdim nasen eis lavram avinu. Either way, there's no attempt to say what actually happened. He doesn't say, well, obviously what happened in the Medrash is true. He said, either way, whatever you say, I'll call upon him. Either way, whatever happened was a nes. O nes nister, shenasan belev oso amelech lahotzi shelo yamisenu. Either it was an ace nister, right? Most of the time, kings would actually kill those who were blasphemous and undermine their credibility and the like. And in this case, the king didn't kill Avram Avinu, but just takes his money and throws him out of the country. Oh, nes meforsam, sheshlicho lekev shana esh v'nitzal kedivei rabbeinu. Or it was in Menes Mephorsam. In other words, no attempt is made to figure out what actually happened. That doesn't seem to be important. There are two versions of the event. And it's interesting because he notes both versions, both accounts, in several places in his Perusha al HaTorah. He also notes that both versions of the story, in a sense, agree more than they disagree, because in both versions Avram was preaching monotheism and he gets in trouble and he's Moser Nefesh and the like. The only question is, was it an Ace Nister or an Ace Nigla? And then the Ramban actually goes ahead and says that the story's omission from the text of the Torah does not undermine its veracity. In other words, it might have occurred. Why isn't it mentioned? So he says, well, if you assume that it happened as described in the Nabataean agriculture, so then it's not included in the text because, like we said, many nisim nistarim are omitted from the text. And if you say that the pshat is like Chazal say, that it was a literal nes, then the reason why it was omitted from the text is because it didn't want to teach us of Avram's early history with idolatry for various reasons. So, again, a fascinating presentation, right? Two versions of what happened. Ramban presents both. He's not machria. And it doesn't seem important to figure out what actually happened. It's important to know both, as we saw from his example of interpreting when mitzvos were given. One more example. Lo sochlu al adam. This is, of course, a very difficult mitzvah to understand. What does it mean, achila al hadam? So Ramban, as he always does, explains the pasuk al pipshat and al pidrash. Totally different interpretations of the pasuk. And then the Ramban says a fascinating thing. He says, well, we actually have a pasuk in Sefer Shmuel, you have that over here, which describes a violation of this halacha. Le'agidu l'sha'ul emor, hinei ha'am chotim l'ashem l'chol al hadam. So again, he says, well, what happened? So al pipshat, X happened, and al pidrash, Y happened. So again, two versions of what actually happened, but he feels no reason to be machria between the two of them. And again, he notes how they're very much related, how much they overlap. In both cases, they reflect the nation's insecurity, their inability to wait. But what's important is to understand the root of the nation's sinful activity, and that's the same whether you explain it al pipshat or drash. And what actually transpired is not actually particularly important. So I gave you the Ramban over here. We don't have time to read it inside. Ayin Shem. So the question then that we want to consider is whether it's important to know what actually happened, because you get the impression from the Ramban that it's not particularly important to know. That's why he always presents two versions or multiple versions of the event. So, before we try to answer that question, it's important to note that Ramban does feel that if you can't actually figure out what happened, it is valuable to do so. It's not that the Ramban doesn't care about Metzius, Lemashal. There's a question where Rachel was buried. So the Ramban famously discusses this in two places. he first interprets the pasuk one way, and then he says, when I got to Eretz Yisrael, I see that my first interpretation was wrong, because I see where Kever Rachel actually is. And he therefore interprets it differently. You can take a look at that Ramban on the bottom of page 12. But, so the Ramban would certainly agree that if you have a tool, if you have the ability to figure out what happened, you should. And in this case, he reinterprets the Pasuk. He says, my initial interpretation was wrong because it doesn't correspond to the Metzios that I see. So, therefore, he suggests a different interpretation. But, as I said, most of the time, we don't really have the tools to figure out what happened, right? There's no way we can figure out whether, in reality, the mitzvos were given at Har Sinai or Midbar Sinai. Or figure out whether Avram Avinu was thrown into a furnace or was just expelled for the land. Or the chait of Shmua, that Shaul was dealing with, Achil al Adam, what literally happened. So therefore Ramban presents both. Now, I think this question of why the Ramban is uninterested in answering what actually happened might relate to a broader question. Some have suggested, and we're going to present their theory now, but we're not going to have a chance to consider whether it's true or not until next time, is, do Chazal really care about history? Is history an important thing to study and to know? It's very interesting. If you look at the Ramban's Hakdama to Perka Chelak, which you have over here, this will have to be our last source, top of page 13, he's describing what Sfarim Chitzonim are. Rabbi Akiva says in the Mishnah in Sanhedrin that someone who reads Sfarim Chitzonim has no Chelak in Olam Haba. So what is Sfarim Chitzonim? So the Gemara has different interpretations. According to one, it even includes works like Ben Sira, despite their having some ethical teachings that the Gemara even sometimes quotes. Anyway, the Rambam writes, what's so bad about studying Sfarim Chitzonim? Right? What's so bad about Sfarim Chitzonim? So you might have said, Sfarim Chitzonim are so bad because they're heretical works. Can't study heresy. So anyone who studies Sfarim Chitzonim, you study heretical works, Eimel Chelak Lom Abbas. The Rambam doesn't say that. The Rambam writes, the problem with studying Sfarim Chitzonim is they're a waste of time. It's perhaps a good chizuk for Elul. The Rambam thinks that wasting time is a really, really, really big deal. So, Kori B'Sfarim Chitzonim, Ein Lo Chelak Lom Haba. Why? It's Bittul Torah. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of time. Rambam also writes why Masachik B'Kuvia is Pasul for Eidos. This is why in Perisha Mishnayos. Mishnah Targum is a different interpretation. Because Ein Lo Osik B'Shuvah Shalom. So what does that mean? Well, the Rambam says everybody in life should devote their life, their time, to one of two things. Either making the world a better place or making yourself a better person by studying Chachma. Misachik Bekovi, it's nothing to do with gambling or for money. It's just a waste of time. It's no value, no purpose. Gambling doesn't make the world a better place. It doesn't make you a better person. So someone who does that is Eino Osik B'Shuv Shalolam, is possible for Eidos. And likewise, he writes here an amazing thing. Right? Sfarim Chitzonim include Sifrei Minim, Sefer Ben Sira. Fine. What's so bad about it? What's so bad about Sefer Ben Sira? Ein b'hem tam v'lo to'eles el ibud hazman behevel. And then he gives some examples. So what are examples of Sfarim that are a waste of time for whom, if you read them, ein lo chelak lom haba? Kigon, eila Sfarim nimtzaim etzel ha'arav misipur divrei yamim, history books, chronologies, hanagas ha'malachim, yichusei ha'aravim, sifrei hanigun. He wasn't so into music either. Okiyotze bahem min asfarim she'em bahem chachma v'lo to'eles gufani. What books should you read? Books that have chachma, philosophy, or medical books that have to'eles gufani. But these are ibud zman bilvad. So, is studying history a waste of time? And maybe it's a waste of time because ma'idehave have. Whatever happened, happened. What difference does it make? And maybe that's the reason why Ramban doesn't bother telling you or trying to even figure out what actually happened. Whatever happened, happened. Doesn't matter. Right? Ave, ave. What's important in Torah is to take out the lessons, the message, the ideas of Torah. Again, it's nice to figure out what happened if you can. But that's really not what's important. Mai dehave have. Someone who goes ahead and is bothered by this question. They read the pshat and it says X happened. They read the drash, it said Y happened. They read a medrash that has two versions of what happened. And they start trying to figure out, what happened? They're missing the point. Mai dehave have. What happened isn't important. What we're supposed to do is learn the Torah and glean its message. So, is that the correct interpretation or not? I'll let you think about it. Let it simmer for a week. And Be'ezus Hashem, we'll pick up next time. I see there are a bunch of questions. I'm happy to take your questions, but if you have to go, you can go, and you can ask the questions personally. Yes? 10:30. We're going to start 10:30 because of your question.
Okay, for you. Granted, as soon as it... As it